You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are...
My name is Ian Benz, Associate Professor of Elementary Science Education at UNC Charlotte, and I think that the person, fictional or non-fictional, fictional in my case, who would be my best friend would be Luke Skywalker.
Rachel Jackson, and... the question of who would my best friend be, fiction or nonfiction? And I think I have to answer both sides because, again, I just break all the rules. Ibn Ezra, he and I would totally be. He's my crush. He's my best friend. He's my guy for nonfiction. But fiction, I'm going to have to go with Data. From Star Trek Next Generation.
Zach Jackson, UCC pastor, Reading, Pennsylvania. My fictional best friend, I think, would be Hagrid from the Harry Potter series.
Oh, yeah.
I just feel like we would have, it's just such a cozy friend. He's so faithful and just so willing to have adventures.
Yeah.
I could totally see you guys like going off and playing in the forest somewhere,
and
like
having a butterbeer,
skipping.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
my real world best friend would definitely not be Thomas Paine because, as much as I love his writings, and Adam's not here to trash talk him, he was really not a good person to be around. There's a reason he didn't have any friends at his deathbed, and it's not just because he was an atheist.
So, Zach, why did you ask this question to get us started today?
Well, at the end of last episode, Adam asked a question that we didn't get to because we didn't have enough time. But in typical Adam fashion, he waited until the end to give his brilliant little insight. And then, in typical Adam fashion, he isn't here to answer it. So,
definitely typical Adam fashion.
Yeah. So he recorded... he recorded himself answering this question and sent it to me, and I would like to play it for us.
Hey, sorry I can't be there today while you guys are recording. Alas, buying a house is a really lengthy process, but we're almost done. At the end of the last episode, we'd been talking about a couple questions that I wanted to ask about holy hospitality and holy envy. I actually mean two different things when I talk about these. For me, holy envy is about what Christopher Stendhal talked about most famously. This idea that there's something in another religious tradition that seems so important and so beneficial and so wonderful that it's something that we're hoping is in our own tradition, something that we would like to adopt and practice and bring over. By holy hospitality, I mean something a little bit different. I'm thinking of the person who, despite all their holiness, there's something about their practice that I despise, something that I wish would absolutely go away. And yet, in the midst of all that, how is it that I make space for them as a religious other in my midst, a religious other who, insofar as they're religious, I do have some sort of deep respect? At least for me, both of these ideas have been deeply shaping of the way that I approach interfaith dialogue and, frankly, thinking about science and religion, particularly in a time that seems as divided as American history and our culture seem to be now. These questions seem more pressing than ever. So part of what I was hoping is that my other compatriots who I've left on the hook to try and answer such a question might try and tackle some of it today. What are the places where holy hospitality and holy envy in these two distinct senses have shaped the way that we approach thinking about church and state, thinking about the relationship of religion and politics? As always, I'm trying not to answer the question that I have asked. And if I were there, I'm sure that Rachel would be forcing me to answer my own question. So, here is at least a shot of two things that came to mind as I was thinking about this. The first is an experience of holy envy, which is when I think about my Buddhist colleagues who I have worked with over the years. For me, there are pieces of meditative practice that I simply don't find in my own tradition of Christian prayer. They affect me differently when I do them. And at the end of the day, it's not part of my tradition. It's something outside my tradition, and it does something I'm not sure my tradition does for me. But there are pieces of it that I feel that I can adopt, and that with authentic concern and practice and respect for that other tradition, there are ways that I incorporate elements of meditation, particularly from the Zen tradition, which is the one that I'm most familiar with and have practiced on occasion, that I now incorporate into aspects of my daily life. My daily life is richer. My sense of what it means to be a Christian has been enriched by the encounters that I've had with Zen Buddhists. In terms of perhaps holy hospitality, oftentimes I have to think more distinctly within my own tradition. And perhaps that's maybe a facet of this that's tricky. But I think particularly of folks in my own little town of Lenzburg. Here we have a practice called church school. On Wednesday mornings, students can choose to be elected, can choose to in third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, can choose to leave during the day at the 9 o'clock hour in the morning, 8 to 9 o'clock hour in the morning, to go to one of the local churches for instruction, particularly in Bible and issues related to Christianity. My son doesn't get to go. And part of it is because I have some deep reservations about the structure of the program, particularly as a Christian theologian. But what I recognize and I see repeatedly from the posts that my wife shows me on Facebook, because I don't get on there, is a community that deeply appreciates this element of its tradition, despite the fact that I find it highly questionable and particularly offensive. For me, figuring out how to make space for that religious otherness, the distance that I feel from folks who disagree with me about this very particular issue, also shapes how I think about my religiosity and how I think about the relationship of church and state in this country. I don't have a good answer about how I want to deal with that in the long run, nor do I really have time to detail for you all of the issues that are at stake in that. But as much as I appreciate my holy envy, I'm finding that my holy hospitality is something that I have to work on a more daily basis. For me, my hope is that this podcast is an exploration of both. And so I'm asking my colleagues here how it is that they deal with these experiences of holy hospitality and holy envy as well.
I always feel like when he asks us questions, they're like so deep. Not that ours aren't, but every time he asks them, I'm always like, man.
This is why Adam is the intellectual heavyweight.
Yes, he is.
I was wondering how many episodes it would take to get to that. So I can answer the first one because I've experienced this many times. Most recently, after starting at the Sinai and Synapse Fellowship and growing in relationship with several Jewish leaders and hearing the way that y'all look at scripture and teach wisdom and wrestle with texts and histories and philosophies and continually make ancient thought modern and applicable in just ways of that are freer than anything really that is in the Christian tradition, at least the mainstream Christian traditions. We are a much more scared people. We're scared of being wrong. We're scared of being labeled as hypocrites. We're scared that if we lose our faith, we lose our community, because our community is based on a common belief system. And so when a person decides that they're having a crisis of faith or that they don't believe in God anymore, they're basically not allowed back in. Mm-hmm. We practice open communion at my church, so anyone who would like to can come forward and take communion. It's between them and God, but most places don't. And you know, if you're not a professing Christian, then they ask that you don't partake in that sacrament. And so in that way, and in other ways, be somewhat ostracized from the community. And so a lot of people continue on with a inauthentic, tepid, outward faith that's not actually there because of a fear. And so they don't push deeper into the mystery. They don't push deeper into the doctrines that they're afraid of because they don't want to lose that. And that's something that I have loved and cherished, especially getting to know you, Rachel, and Jeff, and a number of other people, and hearing all of these stories and about just the way that you teach wisdom is just something that shows up from time to time in streams of Christianity, because obviously we are an offshoot of the same tree, but we developed more in Western Europe and were toxified by Greek philosophy. I'm not a big fan of Greek philosophy and the harm that philosophers did in the early Middle Ages to Christian thought in distancing us from our Jewish roots. And so, yeah, so that's my bit of holy envy that I'm experiencing right now.
That's beautiful. And I'm so glad that we're able to have dialogue, to be able to share what each of our traditions has. And we'd love to hear other people's traditions too. For my piece, holy envy, it might not sound as intellectual as that, but I have such holy envy for Easter egg hunts.
Easter egg hunts, huh?
Easter egg hunts. But hear me out. So, and it's not just from a societal, everyone's doing it kind of thing, or get out and enjoy nature, all those wonderful things. To me, an Easter egg hunt is specifically designed for children. It is to celebrate a particular moment, a particular theological understanding, but then it's translated directly to children and creates an activity which, while adults might enjoy, is really geared for the young. And the reason I say that I have holy envy there is, while much of our Jewish tradition has elements which incorporate children, such as children get to recite the blessing on Hanukkah, the youngest child, and on Passover, the youngest child, Abel, recites the four questions. But I'm sorry. Having children ask questions in front of everybody who's older than them doesn't feel the same as going out and finding chocolate. It's not designed around children. It's accommodating them. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's a very distinct difference. Even our holiday, which is coming up, Sukkot, where we build a tabernacle, build a hut, a temporary structure. And we've said, oh, well, let's decorate it. That could be fun. So we use paper chains and gourds and pictures. And again, that's more of an accommodation. There's nothing inherent in the holiday of Sukkot to say, ooh, we've got to decorate it. It's almost our answer to the Christmas tree. And it doesn't, again, it's there. We certainly do things with children and for children, but they weren't the focus when we decided how we're going to honor and celebrate these holidays. And so I do have some holy envy there. And then just, you know, it's also just pretty and it's just fun. And dyeing Easter eggs is messy and enjoyable, and kids love to get messy. Well, except for my son and me. But generally speaking, and who doesn't love chocolate? So I do. I have holy envy there.
So this is one of the things that Christianity in the West has done very well, is stealing other people's culture and making it their own, right? Because that's a pagan tradition, the eggs of Easter.
Just and like Christmas trees and all that stuff.
And all of that. But when people converted to Christianity, because we are a conversion religion, people wanted to keep the fun bits of their previous religion. And so we said, all right, let's just slap a cross on it and we'll call it Christian.
Absolutely.
So we're able to co-opt everyone else's fun bits and make it our own. So there's some cultural appropriation, some issues with that. Actually, you know what's funny is pretty much every Christian holiday we stole from someone, pretty much. And we just slapped Jesus on the front of it and said it's now Christian, which I'm fine with, first of all. But second of all, there is a Christian holiday that got co-opted by everyone else, and that's Halloween.
Yes.
Halloween, despite the fact that so many churches out there are telling you that you need to get rid of it, is a Christian holiday because November 1st, we celebrate All Saints Day, the day that we remember all of the saints that came before us. We celebrate this great cloud of witnesses that we're surrounded by. And so the day before that, on All Hallows Eve, we mock death. And the original holiday started with, you know, putting up skeletons and spooky ghosts and things like that to make a fool of death itself. And we would put up evil things. It's meant to satirize evil and death. And the children would go door to door and offer prayers in exchange for snacks. And then it got co-opted and turned into a celebration of all things evil and spooky. But it was ours. It was ours first. It's the one holiday that was ours first and got stolen by everyone else. And I'm taking it back.
You know, so when Jews have a question about can Jews do something, we call it halacha responsa. And so there's this whole question, this whole responsa of can Jews do Halloween? Because it is a... its origin is a Christian holiday. And for the generally liberal, generally, you know, modern Orthodox and more liberal than that, the answer is absolutely, totally, right? It is so far removed in our culture for where it came from that absolutely. There's no saints around. But for some Jews, it's still a nope, it's a Christian holiday, regardless of how it's actually practiced in America. So we seminary, too, are having that debate.
Our seminary had a party on Halloween, and the people were encouraged to dress up like saints. And who is a saint that is recognizable? like you wear a toga,
Mary?
Or something, and then you have to like put a name tag on, I guess.
That's weird. I'm sorry. It's just
seminarians are weird. I love them.
Yeah, we are.
How about you, Ian?
What is your holy envy?
I have a few popped up when I was listening to Adam's response. You know, before he gave us his answer, I was thinking about Buddhism and the meditation practices that they use. I've always been very impressed by that. And definitely envious of that. I think, Zach, what you shared reminded me of a conversation, Rachel, that you and I had maybe a couple months ago about the few similarities, potential similarities between the Jewish traditions and Episcopal Church, and about, you know, open to exploration. And so that's something that I've always found fascinating about the Jewish tradition, is that it, at least based on my interactions with you and with Jeff, and, you know, the other Jewish people I know, that people just don't seem closed off to the idea of exploring and asking questions. Over the past 6 or so months, the thing that I've really started reading, maybe a little bit longer than that, but that I've really wanted to learn more about, because I think it sounds really interesting, is mysticism. Like, I really, you know, I know I bring that up often, and I definitely want to do a couple episodes on that if possible, but I find that absolutely fascinating. There's just something about it, and I just don't know enough to really say what that is, but I'm definitely intrigued by what this is. And I think it's, you know, so when I hear Sir, you know, Father Richard Rohr, when he talks, and he talks, identifies as a Christian mystic, and I think of him as someone that sounds very wise, but also recognizes what he does not know, which I think contributes to his sounding wise. It sounds like he does meditation and meditative practices. And so I just feel like, is that a part of that tradition?
Christian mysticism today is a lot about returning to something. And this goes along with Adam's second question, and a little bit of his first question, in that during the period of the Enlightenment and during the Scientific Revolution, when we thought that everything could be explained through reason and logic, capital R, capital L, the church in the West bought into that, and it became incumbent on us to prove everything first before we could say we believe it. And so you get all of these systematic theologians who, through philosophy and natural philosophy, they try to prove God and also prove the Bible. And so this is where you start seeing people taking the Bible literally and
right.
Faith being something that must be explained rationally, and the birth of modern liberal scholarship in the 1800s. And as much as that worked in that era, because that's where people were, it created a church that is, it just kind of lost its center. I don't want to say is spiritually dead. That's the kind of thing I would have said back when I was a fundy. But it lost its center. It lost its connection to the ineffable. In trying to prove, to trying to put words to the wordless, you end up making idols out of your philosophy. And
right.
That happened. And so we are repenting of that. And as the modern Christian mystics try to remind us of the fact that all of our scripture and all the holy stories that we tell are based on these mystical encounters with the divine, that the rest of us are taking their word for them, and then having our own experiences, that there needs to be a return to the indescribable aspect of religion and the experience of religion, and not just the organized discussion of religion, and allowing space for that again, for not having to define your experience of the divine or what the divine even is opening up a lot of doors in this postmodern society, and is making a lot more things open and accessible, spiritually right. speaking. In some ways separates the rational mind from the spiritual experience, and in some ways brings them closer together. So, and so I say that because, to bring it back to Adam's question, the church had a whole bunch of holy envy for secular society in those days. We wanted to be just like them. And so in the process of trying to be just like the Enlightenment philosophers of the day, we lost our sense of who we are. And so now in this world where I think of myself as a scientifically minded Christian mystic, that I need to have some hospitality for people who are not there, for people who still are in that Enlightenment mindset where things need to be proven and shown to be fact, and the parts of our biblical understanding and our doctrinal understanding and our church history are one way and one way only. And I love those people, and I admire their passion and their commitment to their beliefs. I sometimes wish that I could go back to being that person, because it was just, there were a lot fewer sleepless nights when you have an easy answer like that. But I also find myself being more impatient with people like that because I see myself in them. I really like, a couple of weeks ago, Rachel, you said that this is not an evolution of belief, because that implies a positive growth. It is a metamorphosis, a change into something else. So who I am today, this more mystically minded person, is not necessarily better than who I was then. It works better for me. And so I need to learn how to make space at the table for people who are what I was.
You know, in the process of starting, you know, to write my book, and you know, it's a very reflective experience, that in the podcast and in the Bible study too, all of it has been a very, you know, I've been forced to reflect on my thoughts and views on things, and it is challenging, as I have felt the need to defend Christianity, at least the public narrative of it, because of it. I feel like the public narrative is more of a negative narrative than it really needs to be and is. And that's not to diminish historical issues around religion at all, but it's just to say that I don't think it is the way it seems to be portrayed. That I have to remind myself that while I'm feeling the need to defend how I view things in my faith, to not be judgmental of others. And that's tough. I admit I struggle with that. I feel like if people said, "Oh, I don't struggle with that," I would say, "Well, then are you being honest right now?"
Mm. And that's a really good segue into our continuation of this topic. Because at the heart of tolerance and coexistence in a plural society is an inherent contradiction. You cannot be tolerant of intolerance. You cannot be accepting of people that are not accepting, because it falls apart. And so at we talk about liberty and freedom and the First Amendment that gives you the free expression of religion. And you end up with these court cases,
mm-hmm.
like the one that you just sent us about these Christian calligraphy artists in Texas, who...
Arizona.
Was it Arizona?
Arizona.
Oh, you're right. Mm-hmm. Arizona. It's right in front of me. Thank you. That the case was about rejecting potential clients based on sexual orientation. Their argument was that doing so for specific events or commemorating things like same-sex weddings or what have you violated their religious freedoms and forced them to do something that specifically was against their religious ideology. And so if the courts were to force them to accept these clients and to do the work that they say, then that would be in violation of their right to express their religion. But if their right to express their religion violates another person's right to exist freely in society, mm-hmm. which person's right wins? And currently in the protected class in the civil rights law, LGBTQ people are not listed in there.
Right.
Religion, gender, race, ethnicity, age, ability, these are listed. So you can't dismiss a person because they are Black, for example. Or if you are, say, a Jewish bakery and a pair of Amalekites want to come and get their wedding cake made, you can't deny them on the fact that they didn't allow passage in the Exodus. If Amalekites still existed.
They totally still exist.
Yeah.
They existed then and they still exist now.
Yes, the idea of the Amalekite, yeah.
Yeah, the Amalekite is always the one who is most against the Jews at whatever time of the world we're looking at. But I digress. I, you know, I... think I really, really struggle with this one. I gotta say, I do.
Why?
Because why? Well, because of this. So on the one hand, there's no reason to discriminate against anybody for any reason, period, end of story. The opposite side of that is if we're in a capitalistic society and you go to one organization, one company, and they say, no, we won't do that, regardless of the reason, you go to a different bakery, you go to a different calligrapher, you go to somewhere else. I don't like that idea because then it puts the onus on the person who should be a protected class. But what if it's just, I don't want to? We reserve the right to deny service to anyone. Right, that's posted in many places. That way you can just not serve somebody because you don't want to. And if these two women in Arizona, these calligraphers, didn't say why they weren't going to do their invitation for this gay couple, then there wouldn't have even been a court case. So I struggle with, how do we in a capitalistic society say the government is requiring everybody to follow the government laws in non-government entities? And that, I think, is where the difference is. That, to me, is why this is a very different case than the Kim Davis case, which was She is a government employee. She must follow the laws of the government. End of story. Otherwise, she needs to lose her job. This is not that case. And I feel really bad saying that because I'm hearing echoes in myself of saying, well, what about Germany, 1933? What about when all the businesses decide to get together and say, we're no longer in favor of this one particular person, that even if segregation is no longer on the books officially, you can't tell me there's still not discrimination and that it doesn't still exist. So that's where I struggle. Where is the government's job in this?
So to paraphrase my boy T-Pain, in common sense, that government is a necessary evil, and the fact that it's necessary doesn't make it any less evil. It is as much a sign of the fall, and by that we just mean the fact that humans are imperfect, as clothing. This is a callback to Adam and Eve and yada, yada, yada. But it is necessary only in as much as we are imperfect, and when there get to be too many of us, we tend to oppress each other. And so we create governments in order to stop ourselves from oppressing ourselves. If you have a family who gets crash-landed on an island and there's five of them and they're all related, do they need to elect a president? No, of course not. They're a small family and they will work it out together. If more families start crash landing on that island for some reason, if we have like a lost situation here and the island is calling people in, then at what point do you have to start electing officials? Probably after you end up with 50 or 60 people, maybe then you need to start having assigned jobs of people in charge of this production, of that production. And once you get more than 150 or so, then you need to start having elected people to keep everyone else in check. And government is what we decide it is. That is at the core of our democracy. Government is not what some dusty dead people said a couple hundred years ago. It is what we say it is as a people. And so if we decide that these should be a protected class, then they are a protected class. If we decide that they shouldn't be, then they're not. And no amount of wordsmithing ancient documents can weasel your way in or out of that.
But what if the government is wrong?
The government is always wrong.
Exactly.
About something. So like this kind of discrimination against people of color would have been totally fine 50 years ago. 60 years ago. And then when that was repealed, businesses protested. They complained. They said, you're going to ruin us if you're going to force us to serve these people. And this is just big business, big government trying to destroy small businesses. And that's how it was. That's how it was framed in many places when they were forced to accept anyone, despite their ethnicity. And this is not a whole lot different. I mean, there are a lot of scriptural justifications for segregation, a lot of them. And it was a deeply held religious belief that the races are better apart. And now we look back on that and we see it as barbaric. And no, of course you shouldn't be able to deny service to somebody because they're of a different race. No, we know that's false because we were born into that. We were not born into a world that sees LGBT people the same way that we see people of different races and ethnicities. And perhaps I'm positive that our children's generation will look back on us and wonder why we didn't do the same thing. But we are trying to walk this fine and delicate balance here, because my convictions are my convictions and my rights are my right. My liberty is my liberty in as much as it does not infringe on your liberty. And when competing liberties come up against each other, one side has to lose. We can't be tolerant of intolerance, or else intolerance wins and you can no longer be tolerant of anything. It's the fallacy at the heart of tolerance is you can't tolerate intolerance. And so we kind of need, as a society, to come up with an answer to that. Personally, as a clergy person, Jesus would have baked the cake. And he would have brought out the best wine, you know, at the cheapest wine, is it would have just been a bunch of water that he turned into some good stuff. I think Jesus would have written the invitation, and Jesus would have bought a really great present, and he would have gone. Jesus was notorious for making religious people mad because he did things that were non-religious, that they were scandalous. He was always with the scandalous people in society that the religious majority didn't want for various scriptural reasons. That was kind of his jam. So it's ironic now that we're having these conversations and that it's Christians that are the ones defending segregating, and it's non-religious people who are apparently, according to many religious people, amoral monsters, are the ones who are acting more Christ-like.
So going back to this Arizona court case, these sisters, one, they are not required to make art for something that they feel is wrong. And this is where our government is wrong. And that's where I struggle, right? So the government decided on a case, and they decided wrong. And what do we do with that? How do we then say the tides of this era are such that our government is allowing people to be intolerant? We are now living in that dystopia that you're referring to, Zach, of tolerating intolerance. And we are.
Hold on. That's not new.
It's not. But why are we still accepting it?
I believe I see them as equal, LGBTQ issues and racial issues, racial discrimination based on race. It's discrimination. And I don't know the history much about what it was like in court cases prior to the Civil Rights Act. But my bet is that courts were ruling in favor of discrimination. It would not even surprise me if it went all up Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court was ruling in favor of discrimination. Because the idea based on what my understanding of the powers of the government is that the court is there to interpret the laws, not write the laws, right? Like the legislators are the ones who are there to write the laws. And so it took the Civil Rights Act to happen in order for the decisions to start changing based on that legal precedent. So that's what's going to have to happen here. In my opinion, is that the elected officials will be the ones that will have to finally have the courage to step up and make those changes so that the law is more clear on discrimination.
Well, yeah, Plessy versus Ferguson. And was it upheld the constitutionality of racial segregation for in public facilities as long as those facilities were deemed separate but equal.
But
and that's
equal.
Where that phrase came from. And they were never equal, but it gave legitimacy to actual laws of segregation. And the moment that was out, then people started, you know, trying to figure out ways of doing what they wanted to do, using their new liberties to impinge on someone else's.
And to any of our listeners out there, please forgive my ignorance.
Oh, what, on constitutional law? Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I've got Wikipedia open right now, so.
and we know that the internet is always right.
So if there are any constitutional scholars out there that want to correct
me, we'd love to have you on.
Please go ahead and do it.
I just wanted to sort of circle back to this idea of the holy hospitality that we initially started the conversation with. And what we're running up against is people who, in theory, we would respect or trust or whatever words we might give to that. But how we then give that hospitality to someone who we believe is intolerant of differences. And that's where we're still struggling. And often, right, what I heard in Adam's question and his differentiation between these two terms is holy envy is often interfaith, and holy hospitality, I'm getting the sense, is intrafaith, right? So that, right, so in this particular case, it's the more liberal Christians that are going, whoa, you're speaking on behalf of Christians?
Right.
This isn't working for me. That's not what Jesus would do at all. You're reading the Bible in a completely different way, right? So I think that's where the holy hospitality gets us really deeply. And that goes back to the conversation also of how are we reading our scripture? Are we reading it literally? Are we reading it metaphorically? Are we reading it as some really nice stories that somebody wrote once upon a time? Are we reading it as the word of God, infallible as that is? Right? And that question and its coming answer, I think, causes a lot of tension, which parallels the Constitution. How do we read the Constitution? Is it a literal document to not be changed throughout time? And who gets to decide that? So this question of church and state has at its core the scripture and how we interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
Ian, you were going to...
Well, so I was talking about the importance of, you know, it would take lawmakers who have the courage to stand up against, you know, these forces that promote discrimination. And for some reason, I always forget his name, but I would love to meet the guy someday. It's the lawmaker from either like Connecticut or Massachusetts who kind of led the charge for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
So editor's note from the future. I think Ian was referring to Representative from Pennsylvania, Patrick Murphy, who authored this bill in 2010, but he also may have been combining him in his mind with Marty Meehan from Massachusetts, who retired in 2007 before this came to the House, but he was a huge advocate as well. So if you just want to imagine some kind of strange Hydra-esque hybrid between the two, I think that's probably fine. All right, future over, back to the past.
Which, you know, people don't remember, don't ask, don't tell, was implemented in the 90s under the Clinton administration when it came to who could serve in the military. And so that, you know, it made it so that people who identify as LGBTQ, that they couldn't be asked. You weren't, the senior officers were not allowed to ask anyone what your sexual orientation was. So don't ask, don't tell. He fought for the removal of that. And I remember reading an article about it right around the time it was happening that, and I'll have to get his name, but right around the time it was happening that apparently Obama kind of approached him and just kind of said that how good it was that he was spearheading this and leading this effort, but that recognizing this could cost him the election, his reelection. And from what I remember, he said that what mattered more, something along the lines of what mattered more to him was what his children would think someday when they look up to see what did my daddy do when he was in Washington. And that has always stuck with me, mm-hmm. of why can't we have more people like that? Like he did what he thought was right and made sure that that level of discrimination went away, recognizing that all people who want to fight for their country, for our country, have the right to do that. And their sexual orientation shouldn't stop it. And I thought that was a very brave and courageous thing for him to do. And he did indeed lose re-election, but he's moved on. So.
I think that goes back to your question, though it might've been rhetorical. I'm going to try to answer it, of why don't more people act like that? It goes back to our study that we referenced last week, where young people believe that everyone is out for themselves, right? That they're selfish. And, you know, as you just point out, he lost re-election. He had to be willing to stand up for his values, knowing that his livelihood might be completely changed. And that takes a very strong person in order to be able to do that.
Can I jump in here in
2 feet
with both feet? Yes. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned the Constitution. You've mentioned the Bible, how we read and interpret both and how they're meant to be read and meant to be interpreted. I am nearing the end right now of James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And it's so enlightening because it's a mess. And from day one until the end. Actually, at one point, Ben Franklin stood up and said, you know what we need? We need a chaplain. And he tried to hire a full-time constitutional chaplain to be there to keep people under control and to pray for them. But they didn't have money. And so local pastors would just volunteer some time to give opening prayers because people were just not getting along. They were not being civil and they were not agreeing on anything. And because they couldn't agree on anything, they were so afraid that the big states would take over the small states or the small states would have a tyranny of the minority against the big states. And it was just a whole mess. And their conclusions were not to come up with a document that has all the answers. Their conclusion was to come up with a document that was vague enough that future generations could read into it the answers that worked for them. I mean, even the Constitution itself says that no law against slavery can be voted on until the 1830s because it was so contentious in the early days of the Constitution that they were worried that it would divide the fledgling nation before it had a chance to start. And so they pushed it a generation later because they knew that they weren't equipped to make the decisions that needed to be made in that day and age.
So smart.
No, well, I guess it was also just passing the buck onto the next generation, and
lazy. But
it left it to fester, and then we had the Civil War, and you know we're still not over it. We are a different people. We are a very separate people, and finding common ground is difficult for us. And the same is true with our reading of Scripture. Is if you read Scripture as in this is the one truth written in the one way applied to all people for all times, you're going to have a really hard time reading the second part of the Christian Bible. Because Jesus' teachings at the core of it, I mean, he says in the Sermon on the Mount so many times, you have heard it said, but I say to you, you have heard it said, do not kill, but I say to you, do not even hate. You have heard it said, do this, but I say, don't do this. He's reinterpreting the law the way that rabbis are supposed to do, right? That you're, if you are a if you have that kind of religious standing, that it is your job to interpret Jewish law for modern times. And Peter in the book of Acts is sitting on top of his roof and falls into a trance and has this crazy mystical vision of a sheet descending with all kinds of animals on it and the voice of God saying, hey, go to town, eat it all. And he goes, hey, I know this one. This is a test. You're not going to trick me. I have never eaten anything unclean, and I'm not touching any of this stuff. I'm super holy. And the voice says, do not call anything unclean what I have made clean. Go and eat all of it. And then he's awoken by messengers from the centurion, Cornelius, the centurion's people, and goes to his house and witnesses the outpouring of the Holy Spirit and says, my goodness, this is so far outside of my expectations of what how this is supposed to do, how God is supposed to act, but I can't deny what God is doing before my eyes. And so who am I to stand in the way of what God is doing now, what God is doing next, something that doesn't fit into my interpretation of Scripture, but God is doing a new thing. And so he went with it. And the entire story of the early church throughout the book of Acts is the Spirit doing a new thing and then the church going with it and reinterpreting the faith that they were given to the times that they were experiencing. And so I don't understand anymore. I used to understand back when I was a fundamentalist how you could take the entire thing completely literally as if it applies one-to-one to modern situations. But I tell people, the Bible ruined me. The more I studied the Bible, the more it messed me up and the more it made me uncomfortable and made me unable to take easy answers anymore. And like my life was so much better before I studied the Bible. I actually liked the Bible more before I studied it when it was a lot easier to understand because I wasn't understanding it. So I don't think a literal reading of the Constitution is helpful either. And I think it is incumbent on each generation to figure it out. And I think we should have gone with Jefferson's ideas that laws should be impermanent and they should be regularly reevaluated to see if they work in modern times. I also wonder, so a lot of the early racism was not only propped up by constitutional law, but also by bad science. The taxonomy of humanity into all of these different racial groups and the superiority of this, that, and the other. And this is making a comeback now. They're calling it racial realism, I believe.
Oh, yes. What? It's awful.
Yeah, it's awful. It's terrible science. And it is just...
No, it's not science. You can't call it terrible science. It's not actual science. Right? Let's call something what it is.
Pseudoscience?
Just because somebody else calls it science doesn't mean it actually is.
Terrible pseudoscience. It should have a different word for it that doesn't have the word science in it, is it? But I wonder, as because science is often used as a justification one way or the other.
Yep.
If in our explorations of biology and neuroscience, if we start to be able to identify markers of a person that make them more predisposed to one's sexual orientation or gender identity, if we're able to start figuring that out, where in your genes decides that, and we can say scientifically that you're born one way or another, would that change the debate?
No, I don't think so. And it makes me so scared to think about that. We are at the very early stages of scientifically understanding our genome and what it does, and we don't know how to mess with it. Just the other day, talking about the common cold and why we can't cure or get rid of the common cold when we even have something right. for the flu. And part of the answer is, well, because there's over 150 different kinds of quote unquote cold viruses. And so just to get rid of one doesn't mean anything. So maybe instead of attacking the virus, we attack ourselves. We say, oh, we found the protein that allows us to get sick by the cold virus. Let's just remove that. Thank you, CRISPR. And it's like, oh, well, that sounds interesting. Or the same thing for mosquitoes, right? So rather than saying, well, let's just rid the world of mosquitoes, we don't quite know what they do for us other than make us itch. Let's just make us not itch. Remove that piece either from, so don't kill the mosquitoes, just remove a piece of their genome such that when they bite a human, it won't cause us a reaction. But we don't know the domino effect that's going to happen. So if we look at this and say, oh, this is the marker that is going to tell you if you have blue eyes or brown eyes, and this is the marker that tells you how tall you're going to be, and this is the marker that's going to tell you if you are cis, trans, or non-binary, or this is the marker that's going to tell you homosexual, heterosexual, somewhere on Kinsey's 0 to 6 scale, how are we then going to face the possibility that our government will be terribly, terribly wrong again? And we have that information, and then we say, huh, turns out we don't like that particular population, that subset. Let's just remove that gene.
Yeah.
Right? Modern day eugenics. And it scares me. I hope we never even ask that question as a scientist, because what will it prove other than that the people are already telling the truth? We don't need science to tell us that the people are telling us the truth, that when they say they are a gender, that's what they are, regardless of what anatomy says. And if they say, I am gay, then we believe them. And science is not going to help us believe them, because we know that facts don't sway opinions. Soapbox done.
So, yeah, a couple of things. First of all, I think we need to further explore the, because we're talking about these issues, and what these particular lawsuits go into is this notion of religious freedom. And so I would love for us to explore that further in our next episode if possible. But one thing too, I just noticed this back to this first court case we brought about Arizona. No one ever approached these two, and they were actually friends, not sisters. But
thank you.
No one ever approached these two women to do a invitation. Did you know that?
No.
They just made this statement on their
this
own.
This was a preemptive.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Oh my God. Because they've seen the way that things are going, and
they saw the statute that was passed by the city of Phoenix or the state of Arizona. I guess it was the city of Phoenix. So they saw this statute. They were saying that this could impact them. So it was a pre-enforcement civil rights lawsuit. And I need to do a little bit more reading. But again, this gets back into what I think our next topic should be, is about religious freedom. Because I started thinking to myself, I noticed that the case was these two women against a city. It wasn't people versus people. Right. I mean, even though you could say city represents people, but you know what I mean? So it wasn't like, this couple over here or these two artists versus a couple.
Yeah. And it's so like Brown versus Board of Education. It's a person versus an entity. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. That's the word I'm using. So instead of persons versus persons. And so I just find that interesting. I think that kind of tells more about the fact that this was purely preemptive. This was not because they were asked to do something. They didn't do it, and then they were sued. This was them suing the city because of their concerns about the future. Yeah, that's just interesting. It kind of bothers me even more.
I might have to discriminate against. Yeah, I might have to discriminate someone in the future. So please don't make me discriminate against them. Please just put it on the books that I don't have to.
Just understand that, you know, I feel like I'm going to need to. There's a chance I'll have to discriminate based on the cake. And actually, this happened prior to that decision. The first case was put up in 2016, it looks like. So against the city, you know, this went up to the Arizona Supreme Court. So it just makes me, you know, and I, based on a quick reading, it looked like that potentially, and I want to read more about it for our next discussion, but that Phoenix did issue like a statement or something like that against another artistic company or people. And so, they were not approached. They were not challenged to do anything against their own religious beliefs, but they felt the need, I guess, to reach out to this organization, this national organization that does these types of lawsuits. It's the same group that was successful with the Baker case out of Colorado. It's the same group of lawyers. And so is it that anti-defamation? Which group is it again?
It's not the ADL.
Yeah.
This was a playbook that was started during the civil rights movement, that they realized that if you're not going to get legislation through to give rights to people of color, then you need to work through the courts and cherry pick the cases that you'll lose in lower courts so that you can appeal them to higher courts.
Right.
And they're specific, because if they win in a lower court, then that's it. And it only affects the lower court. If you can move it up the chain until you get to the Supreme Court, then you can make a decision that affects everyone. And it's this brilliant roadmap that was like a single lawyer. There's an episode of which podcast is it? I think it's the More Perfect Podcast. I'll put a link in the show notes about this guy who made this roadmap. And then this other guy in recent years who's been using the same strategy in order to undo all of that. And George Washington warned in his farewell letter to be careful not to do the right things the wrong way, because the next person who comes along will use the precedents to then do the wrong things in the wrong way. And
Right.
So if you're, you know, to continually get political, if you're President Obama and you're frustrated with Congress and you can't get things through and you start making executive orders that perhaps overstep what you're technically allowed to do, but you do them anyway for good cause, the next president comes along and then that precedent is set and can use those exact executive orders to undo everything and then do more against what were your convictions. So using the court system in order to force morality swings both ways. And so now we're stuck with this system where it seems like just a handful of people sitting on a court and some clever lawyers have now the power to decide where everything happens. And the Supreme Court doesn't even have this power in the Constitution. It's a power they gave themselves, which is an amazing story that is also an episode of More Perfect, which is a spinoff of Radiolab that deals with constitutional law and is an amazing podcast and you should all listen to. And I'll leave several links in the show notes. I can't believe I'm about to say this, but this has been episode 10 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. Cue the fanfare. Huzzah! Thank you so much for taking the time to go on this journey with us. If you like what you hear, do us a favor and leave us a review on iTunes and follow us on all the social medias. Check us out at downthewormhole.com for show notes and links to the More Perfect episodes you should definitely be listening to next. Next week, we are taking a break from politics to talk with the founder of Sinai and Synapses and the man who brought us all together, the Rabbi Jeff Middleman. We'll be talking about his journey and what's next for the fellowship. It's going to be so much fun. Till next time, Ian, what's our mantra?
And to any of our listeners out there, please forgive my ignorance.